Well, many textbooks that are written about us, I guess, people living today, they talk about how generations living today are much more persuaded by their feelings, by emotional appeal, if you like, than by facts, by truth outlined. A lot of that's been said in recent weeks in terms of the US election and Brexit before it, that it was emotional appeals that did their work. And this is said to be seen in areas of faith as well, why we believe what we believe when it comes to God and his ways. So some are drawn to Christ because his teachings feel good and attractive to them, or because they feel a warmth and a care from church or from Christians. Because testimonies, stories like the ones we've been hearing in these evenings have resonated and tugged at them. But other people, of course, reject Christianity because to them, Christ's teaching feels, perhaps to them, harsh. Or they reject it because they felt a cold shoulder from a Christian or from a church or something like that. And that's the problem, actually, isn't it, with feelings? That sometimes they aren't always the most reliable guide. But don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean that aren't a place for feelings in determining what is true. Even tonight, our guests have talked, haven't they, of the sense they've had of God's Spirit at work in them. Those of us who are married, we only have to think for a moment to recognize there is some truth to feelings. Chaps, husbands, sometimes, if you're like me, you just get an inner sense that something's wrong. You just, deep in your core, darling, is something wrong? But if you're slightly emotionally underdeveloped, as I am, you then start thinking facts. What have I done? You work through your day. I got up. Things seemed all right this morning. I didn't sense this then. What's happened after lunch? Maybe it was something a few days ago. Sometimes they do pop out after a few days. I'm not sure what it is. In other words, your feelings have actually picked something true up. But knowing whether those feelings actually have anything in them at all, you then start to analyze the facts, you see? That's the point. And so it is when we come to consider Christ. When we come to consider the things that we've been thinking about over these last evenings. Whatever you have felt so far, the question is, are there any facts to back that up? Or, indeed, to challenge it. You see, Christianity is not an anti-truth kind of religion. It's not about belief that is blind. And I'm very aware that that might actually be news to some people here, because before I was a Christian, when I didn't even believe in God, I presumed it was blind. There were no good reasons to believe. In his book, The God Delusion, the atheist Richard Dawkins writes, "The whole point of religious faith, its strength and chief glory, is that it does not depend on rational justification." And then he, rather angrily, says, "But we have to justify what we believe, so why shouldn't they?" I'm sorry, Mr. Dawkins, but that's not Christian faith at all. No, in reality, I'd want to say, there are too many good reasons to believe that Jesus is God's Son and King for me actually to deal with in half an hour. Far too many. But they can be gathered together under four key witnesses, which I'm going to go through quite quickly before we spend time on the fourth. First, if you've never really thought about this, think about the witness of the universe itself. Quite deep and profound, I know. Have you been watching Planet Earth Mark 2? I thought they could have come up with a rather more interesting title for it, apart from Planet Earth 2. But have you been watching it? I mean, it is astonishing, isn't it? But have you thought about what that really means? The astonishing, interdependent complexity of this universe, whether at the level of the cosmos or creatures or the cell, doesn't just point, some would say just blatantly and obviously, to a designer, but a designer who is profoundly wise and powerful, beautiful, kind and terrifying. Did you see the one with the snakes? Second, though, what about the witness of our own humanity? We've thought about this in previous evenings, if you've been here. The fact is that throughout history, human beings have had an innate longing for God, for something beyond. And it's not just that either. We have a deep sense of justice. We have a deep sense that those who suffer should be cared for. That selflessness is something noble to be held high, even though none of that particularly helps us develop as creatures. Well, if this universe is chance and random, there's no really convincing explanation for that. But no, these things point to a God who is moral and good, from which these things derive. Well, third, think about the universe, our humanity, the Bible, for a moment. Now, I'm aware many of you won't have had as much experience of that as you have of the universe and of yourself, but it's worth pondering. You've got 66 books written over 1,500 years, all popped together. And when you do get to know it, there is an astonishing consistency to them. They have transformed literally billions of lives. They are filled with predictions that we call prophecies that were, well, they matched Christ's life hundreds of years after they were given. And the Bible records the history of this nation Israel, an astonishing history that really the nation survives against all human reason. It all points to God being at work in that history, God being behind the existence of this book. Now, of course, a lot more could be said, and skeptics have responses to these kind of things, and you'd have to talk them over. I'd be very, very happy to talk to you if you want to talk further about those later. But it's the fourth witness that is the major one. This is the one the Bible makes much of, the Christians should be making much of. This is the reason, ultimately, why we believe what we believe. It is the witness of Jesus himself. And that's what takes us to the passage we're going to have read for us in a moment. We've seen throughout this week that Jesus claimed to be the Son of God. That is, the God who made everything, walking in human history as a man, to reach out to us, to call us to himself. That he is what they called the Messiah, that is, a king who is going to roll over God's kingdom, a kingdom of all goodness in a world beyond this one, made right, free from all that's bad today. A perfect world order entered into beyond death and lived for even now. Well, our passage begins 3 days after the man who made these claims was crucified, died, buried in a cold tomb, big stone across it. 3 days after that, you can imagine how his followers would have felt. All is surely lost. He's dead, he's wrapped up, he's in the tomb. What evidence could Jesus possibly give that he really is this Son of God, this King, as he taught? Their hopes would seem dashed. What reason could they have for their faith? What basis for believing what they'd believed up to that point? Well, if you've got one of these John's Gospels on your chair, do pick it up. It comes straight out of the Bible. It's an eyewitness account of Jesus' life and teaching from one of his closest friends. And Isabel's going to come and read to us. She's going to read from chapter 20. If you find page 61, and we're going to read from that very little 19 underneath where it says, Jesus appears to his disciples.
On the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And after he had said this, he showed them his hands and side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father had sent me, I am sending you." And with that, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone's sins, their sins are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven." Now Thomas, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciple told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your fingers here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put them into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Then Jesus told him, "Because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Thanks be to God.
Thank you so much, Isabel. Have a look down while you've got it open in front of you at that verse 31. Isn't it astonishing? Doesn't it turn over our assumptions about faith? These, that is everything you've got in this little book in your hand, these have been written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. That's how we know it's true. The things that Jesus said and did. We've talked about this during the week, haven't we? His character and his teaching points to him being so much more than an ordinary man. Just consider it. Dwell on it. Chew it over. Read this book. Doesn't matter if it's in the loo, wherever you can get some peace and quiet. His character and his teaching are exemplary. They display an otherworldly goodness and wisdom that points to him being just who is he claimed, the Son of God, come here as a man. I'd want to suggest that the writers of the Gospels couldn't even invent such a profound character and wisdom as you find in these Gospels. But you know, it's the things that Jesus did in particular, what we call miracles, they are his spiritual CV for us to consider. Let me ask you for a moment. Do you believe that Alexander the Great was indeed great? Not in terms of, you know, whether he was an upstanding man. I think we all know the answer to that one. But was he great in terms of his military prowess? Yeah, of course he was. Now, I didn't even expect such response, but that's great. It was a rhetorical question, but that's wonderful. Thank you. You're alive. It's good to know. Now, if I was to ask you how you know that, you would probably appeal to history, wouldn't you? And even if you're not sure, you know that you could do a bit of research and you would come to a conclusion, convincing one, as to whether Alexander the Great was indeed great. You might think about the fact that he conquered much of the known world by the age of 32, around about the age that Jesus himself died. In fact, no one would frown if you said, "Look, the testimony of history here proves that Alexander the Great is great. So I'm quite prepared to believe that Alexander the Great is great on the testimony of history," do you see? That's how we work, isn't it? Well, let me ask you, in what way is believing that Jesus is Lord of creation any different from believing that Alexander the Great was truly Lord of the Greek Empire? I'm not sure there's a fundamental difference between the two at all. Jesus taught that he'd come to rid the world of evil and suffering and death. And what do we find him doing in history for us? Driving out evil from those that it's got a particular grip on. Healing the sick. Raising the dead. You see, Alexander proves that he is this great general by driving out armies. Jesus drives out all that's wrong with our world. Of course, some question whether the Gospels are really reliable. Can we really trust what John has recorded for us, or Matthew, Mark, and Luke, for that matter? Well, the authors of these Gospels, they knew these things didn't just happen. Luke was actually a doctor. They knew you couldn't just state these things and accept people to put their life on the line for them. They would only have recorded them if they were indeed convincing in their own day. And those who wrote these Gospels, They didn't have anything at all to gain by writing them. It's commonly known that these first Christians were hounded for their faith. It wasn't just that they lost homes and lost loved ones. Many were in prison. Many were put to death. They had nothing to gain by lying. And we know these Gospels were copied. They were scattered so quickly after the events that there was no time for them to get fabricated or for legend to creep in. Now, we mustn't forget the various stories Christians have told us this week and that we've heard this evening. They join to that testimony of the Gospels, don't they? Signs that Jesus is indeed the Christ, the Son of God, giving life to those who put their trust in him. He is still alive and at work in this universe. And it's here that we have to consider what we call the resurrection. It is why we believe Jesus is still at work, that he didn't stay in that cold tomb, but he came alive again. More than that, he was seen by hundreds of followers over a period of 40 days, and then they actually, literally saw him rise up from the earth, being hidden by a cloud as a way of showing that actually he was now passing from earth into this spiritual realm we call heaven. We're great fans of the TV series Suits. Have I got anyone with me on that? I've got a few, thank you. Yeah, it's worth seeing if you've never watched it. Now, Suits has suddenly become very famous because the love interest in Suits actually happens to be Prince Harry's love interest, but we can put that aside. Suits is about a guy called Mike. Mike is a bit of a dropout, but he's got a photographic memory. So in order to get on, what Mike does is he fakes a degree from Harvard. He gets a friend to fix the computers so that it looks like he really studied there. And with his great ability, he signs up to a legal practice. And Mike's ability means that he rises to the top very quickly. He doesn't have a conventional CV by any means. Of course, it's a fake. But what you find as you watch the series is that you're really for Mike. You're for him because even though he hasn't got a degree from Harvard, Mike can do the job. He is the top lawyer. He does win the cases. And they're very thankful to have him. And so it is with Jesus. He may not have the qualifications that you would like him to have. People sometimes say, well, look, you know, if Jesus appeared to me, then I'd believe. If he'd healed my loved one, then I would have believed. If he emphasized in his teaching the things that I think are important in teaching, well, then I'd believe. It's all very me, isn't it, actually? Well, no, Jesus doesn't come to us like that. He doesn't come to sort of meet what we want from him. He doesn't have the CV that we would like, but he does have a CV. The CV for Jesus are the things that he proved himself able to do. They're the things that show he's qualified and can be trusted in the promises that he makes. They're all played out in the Gospels. And nothing amongst those is more important than this resurrection from the dead. If Jesus rose from the dead, then all this stuff about eternal life beyond death, the new life that started to be experienced now, well, it's proved that he can deliver it, isn't it? That he can give it, that there is a world beyond this one. But did you also notice the word that flows through the passage that was given to us? It's the word peace. If you want to follow it, I'm going to read a little bit more out, but you can just listen if you'd like to. Page 61, from verse 19. We read that on the evening of the first day of the week, this is after Jesus has been put in the tomb, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father sent me, I'm sending you." And with that, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. Now, if you forgive anyone's sins, their sins are forgiven. And if you don't forgive them, well, then they're not forgiven. Peace is the catch-all term for what Jesus achieved in his death on the cross. We saw it last night. God is outraged by the wrong that we do as human beings. The different degrees, yes, but nevertheless, we all do it. Because God is so good, he must display his opposition to that wrong by judging it. More than that, for his will to have any force for us at all, of course, there must be an accounting, a penalty, a punishment, if you like, for doing that wrong. But in his love, God sent his one and only Son to his death on the cross to satisfy the demands of that justice, to pay that penalty, to be punished, as the Bible puts it, on our behalf, so that we might not have to face that. Have you ever noticed when you try and pay for something online, if you use the internet, that you click pay, and you'll get some kind of a pop-up window, won't you? Saying, yeah, thank you, paid, it's done. If you don't get that, you start hitting again like you do on computers, and I get rather terrified I might have paid 10 times. The pop-up window, I'm thankful, I know it's done, I don't have to keep trying and trying and trying. Well, so it is with the resurrection. Jesus pays for our sins in his death on the cross and then pops up. Paid. You don't need to keep clicking, keep trying. Try to be as good as you can to pay this off yourself. It's done once and for all. And the resurrection proves it. And so the first thing he proclaims, just like your computer proclaims, paid, is peace. Because, of course, if he's paid it, then forgiveness is now ours. If he's paid it, then we have peace with God. And because God's life then starts to come and work within us, we then start to have inner peace, even through the turmoil of life, as our friends have testified in their testimonies. More than that, as God starts to work a love not just for him, but for others within us, we start to have peace, so far as it depends on us, with other people too, and with the world around us. All because it has been paid on the cross. Do you see now why the resurrection is just so important for us? We talked about Mike, TV fictional at Harvard. He's a real character, Simon Greenleaf. He was a key founder of Harvard, the law school. So he's all about law. He wrote a 3-volume work called A Treatise on the Law of Evidence. So, world expert, perhaps one of the greatest lecturers in evidence there has ever been. It's apparently one of the greatest works ever written. Well, it seems that as an unbeliever, Greenleaf decided to use his knowledge of evidence and fact to disprove this resurrection thing once for all. But, you guessed it, like many other people that we could mention, he looked into the facts and was convinced. And he became a Christian. He then went on to write this. All that Christianity asks of people is that they would be consistent with themselves, that they would treat its evidences as they treat the evidence of other things, and that they would try and judge its actors and witnesses as they deal with their fellow men when testifying to human affairs and actions in human tribunals. Let the witnesses to the resurrection be compared with themselves, with each other, and with surrounding facts and circumstances, and let their testimony be sifted as if it were given in a court of justice on the side of the adverse party, the witnesses being subjected to a rigorous cross-examination. The result, it's confidently believed, will be an undoubted conviction of their integrity, ability, and truth. He's the world expert on evidence, who's written the book of books on evidence. And the evidence convinced him. Weigh it up objectively, as you would any other case. And the evidence that Jesus rose from the dead is not just compelling, but convincing. We don't have time for all the facts, but it's worth us considering a few while we're here. The key question to answer is this. How do you explain accounts like the one we've just read from John's Gospel? How do you explain the readiness of men like John and others to die on the conviction, not just that they'd found a tomb empty,
could have gone to the wrong one, someone could have stolen the body. No, that wasn't what they were saying. On the conviction that they'd actually seen Jesus over a period of 40 days and then seen him rise up into heaven. What about fabrication? That's the most obvious one to think about, isn't it? But it's the same as with the Gospels. We've thought about it already. These disciples had no reason to make this stuff up. People will die for what they are sure is true, even if they are mistaken. But no one's going to die for something they know is false in the first place, are they? And not one of the hundreds who claimed that Jesus rose ever reversed their testimony, even under duress. And you could be sure that their opponents would have recorded it for us if they had. So if it wasn't fabricated, what about hallucination? What about wishful thinking? The image of someone who you've loved and lost. Well, individuals do sometimes hallucinate, but have a look at verse 19 if you want to. This is a whole group of people, isn't it? Of these disciples. They weren't expecting this at all. And look down at verses 20 to 23. They have a clear conversation with this person in front of them. Well, hallucinations don't work like that. Perhaps most compelling here is Thomas himself, who sees Jesus a week later. I'm sure, because we live in Crowborough and we're by Ashdown Forest, everyone knows Winnie the Pooh. Okay, so you know what I mean by Eeyore? Thomas was a bit of an Eeyore. Okay, there is suggestion when you read through the Gospels that he was the glass half empty kind of character. Dad reminded me earlier on, there's one time when Jesus says that he's going to go where people are opposed to him. And Thomas's response is, oh, okay, yeah, we'll come and die with you. So what happens here when, excited, his friends are saying, hey, we've seen Jesus, he's alive. Well, verse 24, unless I put my finger in where the nails were and put my hand in his side, I'm not going to believe. I've not experienced it yet, but do you know, cinemas apparently do 4D. Has anyone been to a 4D experience yet? Okay, we're all that. Oh, young person over there, okay. So 3D, I've just about got. You put the glasses on and things come out of the screen for you. 4D is a whole new level. So what I understand on 4D is if you're watching a film and there's a gale force wind in the film, fans go on and you get blown about in your seat. And, you know, if someone jumps into the water and water splashes up onto the screen and out of the screen, someone, I assume it might be someone or some machine, splashing water into your face as well. And they're all sitting by a log fire, you know, in a Western, and smoke, smell and scent suddenly comes past you. So it's a real tangible 4D experience. Is that right, young person? Yeah, okay, general kind of thing. It doesn't really appeal to me because I think, yeah, log fire, nice smell. The horses, though, I'm not so sure. But what Thomas, doubting Eeyore, glass half empty Thomas, gets in this appearance of Christ is a 4D experience. Can you see it there from verse 27 onwards? Hallucinations don't come this way. Jesus says to him, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe. This is no hologram. This is no hallucination. Touch me and see. Flesh and blood. I'm no ghost with my body still in the grave. I'm here. Well, we should add that Jesus then appeared to hundreds of his followers over a month after that. Were they all mistaken? Really? Well, if they were, Jesus' body was still in the tomb. So you'd expect the Jewish and the Roman leaders to go and get it, wouldn't they? And stop this new thing before it even got started. No, fabrication doesn't work, nor does hallucination. Well, perhaps we might say, and I think this is the only other alternative other than Jesus was raised, was that actually he never died. Well, the Romans were expert executioners. Jesus is showing Thomas a gash in his side where the spear went in and pierced his heart, so that water from the sack around the heart as well as blood poured out. And John noted that, even not knowing what that meant. More than that, we saw this morning that before Jesus was crucified, he was whipped brutally by the Romans. He'd had a crown of thorns put on his head. This man had been tortured. He then had to carry his heavy cross to where he was crucified by being nailed to it through his wrists and through his ankles, 3 hours suffocating there. To say he never actually died is to say that despite all that, despite then spending 3 days in a cold tomb with those wounds and all that torture, he was able to roll its heavy stone away with those wrists and walk into Jerusalem on those ankles and appear to his disciples, good as new, to convince them that he is now in the body fit for the world to come. Would you be convinced? I'm not sure at all. Of course we wouldn't. And we have to then factor in the fact that the disciples didn't just see him once, they saw him numerous times, and then saw him rise up into the sky. I don't know about you, but I've only seen that on TV. That's the point. It's a unique event for a unique man, a convincer that something wonderful is happening. No, Jesus did rise from the dead, proving that he is God's Son and King, and therefore all that we've heard this week, whether it's in the talks from the Bible or the testimonies about the risen Jesus being at work, yes, it is all true. Yes, it doesn't just have to be believed by a tug at the heartstrings. It's true. There are good reasons, compelling, convincing reasons to believe it. But before we finish, I want to acknowledge that it is hard in our 21st century world to believe this stuff. I think one reason is that we're a culture that's just learnt that we can explain everything away. There's almost a sense in which we've lost that sense of wonder. An article I read this week listed some of the different body parts scientists can now grow from stem cells in the lab. I've left some of them out to keep the evening appropriate. But they can now grow in the lab from stem cells a fallopian tube, a stomach, a mini lung, a mini heart, and a mini brain. Pretty good. We can map DNA. We can 3D print a human ear. Well, if we, that the Bible tells are made in the image of God, can do that already, how much more should we expect the maker and sustainer of our universe to be able to raise his son from the dead? The kind of things that we can do now, 200 years ago, people would have regarded as utterly impossible. So if we can do that, surely the one in whose image we are made can do so, so, so much more. How confident then we can be, not only that he raised his son from the dead, but he is able to renew and raise us, just as Jesus promised. The message of this whole week is that there is a God. He's proved it by raising his son from the dead. He's a good God. He's a personal God. He's an unfathomably pure and powerful and wise being who sustains this universe. He's made us. He knows everything about us. And still, despite that, he loves us. And so he hasn't left us alone. He has entered into our world in his son Jesus to call us back to him and to open up the way back. As Jesus met his disciples, he declared, "Peace be with you." That's what God the Son has achieved, forgiveness with God, peace with our Maker, peace in our hearts, peace with our world, peace forever in the coming kingdom of God. An examination of the evidence brought Thomas to respond in verse 28. Did you see it? Seeing Jesus, my Lord and my God. I'm not really sure what else you could say. But Jesus doesn't leave it there. He responds to Thomas, doesn't he? And as the festival comes to a close, do hear Jesus' words, because actually he's speaking to us in verse 29. He says to Thomas, because you have seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. That's many people here, isn't it? That's potentially every single one of us. Jesus says to you, look, blessed is Thomas because he's seen and believed, but blessed are you who haven't believed. If you haven't seen, if you believe, you have joy in God. Christian belief is not blind, it has basis. And Jesus teaches that for those whose hearts are open, what the Gospels record for us are sufficient for a firm faith in him. Verse 31, these things are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. That's our prayer for you this week. Steve.